listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Good evening and welcome. A thrill to be here tonight. Our first Aloud at the Writers Guild Theater for an evening with Colm Toubine and Rachel Kushner. Welcome to Aloud. I'm Louise Steinman, the program director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. I know many of you're already our Library Foundation members. I want to thank you so much for turning out tonight, for making your way here from whichever part of town you came. We're delighted to see you here tonight. The format tonight will be a conversation between Rachel and Colm, and afterwards we will open to you for questions, and we have a microphone there and a microphone there, so we will ask you to queue up, as they say. And we will do as many questions as we can. And then afterwards, both of our authors will be signing books in the lobby. And books are on sale tonight, courtesy of our library store. And just a little reminder that it is your membership and support of the Library Foundation and your purchase of a book on site that really helps support the library and helps make these programs possible. So we thank you so much for your support. And we also have a membership table out there. So if you're not a member, please inquire, and we have a few gifts we have from our Aloud bookshelf if you want to consider becoming a member tonight. There isn't world enough and time, really, to recount all of Colm Toubine's honors and accomplishments, but one basic fact you must know, Colm Toubine was born in, and I've been practicing saying this in the green room, Enniscorthy, in County Wexford, Ireland, and from that detail, you can extract a lot. Of course, since his childhood there, he's traveled far and wide. He lived in Barcelona, worked as a journalist and travel writer. His books have received fervent accolades and have been translated into more than 30 languages. He's currently Mellon Professor of Comparative Literature at Columbia, and his magnificent writing and his origins in Enniscorthy place him in the great tradition of Irish expatriates like Beckett and Joyce before him. He's well known as well for his criticism and nonfiction, as well as his fiction. Read his insightful piece in the London Review recently on religion and the work of Marilyn Robinson, who spoke last night at Aloud, or his essential essay collection, Love in a Dark Time, Gay Lives from Wilde to Almodovar, and don't miss the breathtaking essays on James Baldwin and Oscar Wilde. In novels like The Master and Brooklyn, Toubine excavates the joys and sorrows of displacement, both physical and metaphorical. In his latest work of fiction, Nora Webster, already heralded as a masterpiece, which he'll discuss tonight with Rachel Kushner, he returns us to his homeland, to the tumult of family in factual and fictional Enniscorthy in late 1960s rural Ireland, when the Troubles are just starting to rear their head. The Guardian reviewer raved of Nora Webster, "It does everything we ought to ask of a great novel. It responds to the fullness of our lives, as large as life itself." Toubine's protagonist, Nora, as you will soon meet her, if you haven't read it already, is complicated, funny, infuriating, and deeply admirable. She's recently widowed and now the single mother of four, and she finds her bearings in her new life, which we witness both the self-doubts and the true instincts. Her choices often bring her up against social conventions in her small town where everybody knows everything about everyone. She also conjures up the fiercely unsentimental Mary, the mother of Jesus, from Toubine's prize-winning 2012 novella, The Testament of Mary, also produced as a play and available as a stunning audiobook as read by Meryl Streep. And he will discuss his new work tonight with Rachel Kushner, much acclaimed for her two novels, 2008's Telex from Cuba, a politically charged montage of American expatriate life in Batista's Cuba, and The Flamethrowers, a bestseller just out in paperback set in 1977. Flamethrowers tracks a fiercely memorable character, an unnamed girl nicknamed Reno after her hometown, who stumbles purposefully into post-industrial Soho and then riot-roiled Rome. In Kushner's stunning narrative, We meet unforgettable dreamers, poseurs, and raconteurs, squatters, and industrialists. Flamethrowers generated huge excitement and discussion on this continent and beyond. I've had the pleasure of hearing Rachel and Colm talk about their work in conversation, and I was so moved by their mutual curiosity about each other's creative process and sources, the similarities and differences. So tonight, you all have the pleasure of listening in, and we'll open with a reading by Colm Tubine from his beautiful new novel, Nora Webster. Enjoy the evening.
Thank you very much for coming. Thank you, Louise. I'm going to read two short bits from the book. In the first one, I suppose the 1960s came, I think they came late to Ireland, and they came in strange ways. And one of the ways was that women really changed how they dressed and how they moved. But the big change, especially if you were like me, a small boy, the big change was when you suddenly saw Mrs. Murphy, or Mrs. whatever she was called, with an entirely new colour on her hair, just trying to brazen it out on the street, with everyone talking about her. People then slowly got used to her, of course, but the first few days were always remarkable, really. And all of them did it. I mean, all of them went grey. Obviously, it was what you did in the 50s. And obviously, in the early 60s, you continued it. And then obviously, this new product arrived, and well, I think it changed everything, really. So this is Nora Webster, and there's a reference here to Jim, who is her very conservative brother-in-law, and Margaret, who's her also very conservative sister-in-law. It's Ennis Gorthy. It's 1968, and Nora's husband is 6 months dead, and her two sons who come in at the end are called Donal and Connor, and they're about sort of 12 and 8. On Wednesday morning, she went downtown and had her hair done. Talking to Bernie in the hairdressers about a new system of dyeing hair that she'd read about, wondering if it was time that she did something about the grey. "I wouldn't like it blue," she said. "I know what you mean," Bernie replied. "And if it was too black, then it would look dyed, and I was never blonde. Everyone in the town knows I was never blonde. Is there a good brown so that it might not look dyed?" "I could try this one." Bernie showed her a package with a photograph of a woman with curly brown hair that looked natural. "Maybe just start off with a small bit," she said. "No, the instructions say to use the whole thing. I've used it before. It's very popular. You would be surprised who has it." "Well, try it so," Nora said. Once the dye had been applied, Bernie put a nylon net on her hair and left her to flick through some magazines. When she saw that she would not be at home in time to cook a proper dinner for the boys, she regretted having come here at all and knew that she would have to go soon. She signaled to Bernie, who was now busy with two women who had come in together and appeared to need to consult each other about each clip of the scissors. I'll be right with you," Bernie said. When she came over to remove the net, Bernie told her not to worry or look too closely, as the real change would come only once the dryer and a brush and comb were used. Nora was aware that the two women Bernie had been looking after were studying her closely. Nora wondered if she should not have consulted other women before getting her hair dyed for the first time, but she couldn't think of anyone she could have asked. Both of her sisters, she presumed, dyed their hair, but she'd never heard them talking about it. Slowly, as she watched Bernie working with the hairdryer, she realized that she was being given the hairstyle of a much younger woman, and that the women watching it all happen knew that and were taking it in with considerable satisfaction. The more Bernie worked, the more her hair seemed to look like a wig. She knew that the dye would take time to wash out, but in the mirror, she could see how pleased Bernie was with her own work. There would be no point in complaining. Is it not a bit young for me?" she asked. "I think you look great," Bernie replied. This cut is very fashionable at the moment." "I've never had a fashionable cut before," she said. When it was finished, she knew that anyone who saw her on the way home would think that she had lost her mind. Or that she was trying to look like a young woman rather than someone who was recently widowed. "It'll take a few days to get used to," Bernie said, "but no one has grey hair anymore. Does the dye not look unnatural? In a few days, it will lose that look, and people will think that you've had it all your life. You look very worried, but I promise you that by the weekend, you'll be delighted with it. You can't wash it out, can you?" "No, but it will fade, and I guarantee you'll be back here in a month for the same again. I've never known anyone to go back to the grey. But maybe the next time we'll think of putting some highlights in. They're all the rage now as well." "Highlights? Oh, I don't think so." Outside, she lifted her head high and hoped that all the women in Court Street and John Street would be busy cooking and that none of them would be standing at the door. She prayed that she would meet no one she knew. In her mind, she went through the worst possible encounters, the people who would most deplore the idea that with her husband 6 months in the grave, she had dyed her hair a colour it had never been before. She thought of Jim, this is her brother-in-law. She knew that she would have to face him and Margaret within a week. They would not know what to think. She saw Mrs. Hogan from John Street walking towards her. Nora could not tell whether Mrs. Hogan simply did not recognise her or if she wanted to get by her without making any comment. Just as Mrs. Hogan approached her, she seemed almost to jump. Her face quivered and then she stopped. "Well, that will take some getting used to," she said. Nora tried to smile. "Was it Bernie?" Mrs. Hogan asked. Nora nodded. "I heard she got some new packets in all right. God, I must go to her myself." If Mrs. Hogan, in her apron and a pair of very worn-looking shoes, felt that she had the right to comment on Nora's hair, then there was, Nora felt, no reason why she could not comment in reply. "Well, you know where she is," she said dryly, looking at Mrs. Hogan's hair, clearly suggesting that it could benefit from some treatment. It took Mrs. Hogan a moment to take in the possibility that she was being insulted. As soon as the boys, who are the sons, saw her, they both became quiet. Donna looked away while Connor moved towards her. He reached up and touched her hair. "It's all hard," he said. "Where did you get it?" I had my hair done this morning," she said. "Do you like it?" "What's under there?" Under what? "Under what you have on your head." "What I have on my head is my hair." "Are you going to go out?" he asked. Donald glanced at her again and looked away. In this second bit, the Irish painter Tony O'Malley lived in Enniscorthy, where he worked in the bank in the 1940s. And about 40 years later, he had lived for many years in St. Ives in Cornwall, where he had painted. And he had a touring retrospective in Ireland, and it came near to the town of Enniscorthy. So he thought he would come back there, coming back for the first time in almost 40 years. And it being just only 40, you know, it wasn't very long, in relation to history and things. I mean, everyone recognised him and people spoke to him. And among the people who spoke to him was the daughter of the boarding house where he had stayed. This is a true story. He told me this himself. And, that doesn't mean it's true, but you know what I mean. And as she was leaving him, she said, "By the way, that suitcase you left, you know, you can come and collect that any time. It's fine. It's not a problem there." And so he went around and he found a suitcase and it was filled to the brim of drawings and gouaches and watercolors that he thought he had lost. I mean, along the way, moving as he did so much in those years, he thought were gone forever. And they were of the town and the whole area around the town. And some of them were very precise, all of them, in fact, had been made from the landscape or from streetscape. But there were some of them that no one would know that about because They were done on a stretch of the Wexford coast in the southeast of Ireland that has eroded. So I've seen these drawings and gouaches and watercolours of a hill, the hill behind Keating's at Ballyconiger near Blackwater in County Wexford. But the hill is gone. The hill has completely disappeared. and Keating's house that was always there in front of it, that's gone as well with the erosion. And even this year, there was a house at Christmas. You could see that it wasn't going to last. And then when I went back in the summer, the people had gone. It's a sort of an Irish way of dealing with things. The euphemism they use is along there is, they went into the village, meaning the house fell over, you know, and they went into the village. My father's first cousin, for example, Dick Whelan, Dick went into the village. And you can still see the actual fireplace of the house that was there, but he went in. And if you go south from there, then there are no cliffs anymore. The landscape gets softer. And there's still, even now, a convent of the nuns of St. John of God. And when we were kids, it was terrific because you'd be on the strand and you suddenly say, Mammy, look, there's a nun. And there could be two nuns. And they looked as though they had come out of the deep or that they were somehow or other creatures, you know, and they might be coming to dangerous in some way, but very interesting because they would be in their full black habits on a summer day. And even though Vatican II and all that didn't matter, they were in their black habits and walking along and this sort of landscape, which, you know, there was very little colour, so black was, you know. And anyway, that's still there. And then if you go further south, the strand gets longer and there are more dunes, which is called Curraghcloe. It's very like somewhere in Normandy, so much so that they shot the Norman sections or the Normandy sections of Saving Private Ryan on that particular stretch of the Wexford coast. Nora has got a job and she's being bullied at work. And she's found herself one day, she had to drive to work in the old car because she was late because she hasn't been sleeping. And she'd fallen asleep at the very wrong moment and was almost late for work. And anyway, had a fight at work and found herself picking up a big pair of scissors and almost attacked the woman who was annoying her with the scissors. But then she finds herself out on the street, having walked out of her job, with a pair of scissors in her hand. She can't think where to go. She doesn't want to go home. So she decides just to get into the car and to drive to this place where she had spent so many summers when she was married. And so this is along that stretch of coast that I've just described. She had not expected to find a haze over the water. She sat in the car in front of the Keating's house and looked down in the direction of Rosslare, taking in the heavy milky light that lay over the strand going towards Curraghcloe and Raven Point. When she got out of the car, she felt how unusually close and humid it was, as if there was thunder coming. She put on a pair of flat shoes that she kept in the car. There were no other cars in the car park. She walked carefully on the stony stretch between the grass and the river and crossed the small wooden bridge and made her way south. In all the years, she thought, she'd never come here even as late as in the season as October. She imagined now how strange it would be in December and January, how storm-swept and wintry and how biting the cold. There was hardly any colour. The world in front of her had been washed down. If she moved nearer to the shore, she could look at the small stones that made a rattling sound when the waves broke over them. She saw how exact the colour of each stone was, and it allowed her to forget work and stop worrying about what she would do. She could barely see ahead of her as she walked. It might have been easy to imagine that this was a place that belonged more to Morris than to her. Morris is the name of her husband who has died. It was the world filled with absences. There was merely the hushed sound of the water and stray cries of seabirds flying close to the surface of the calm sea. She could make out the sun as it glowed through the curtain of haze. It was unlikely that Morris was anywhere except buried in the graveyard where she'd left him. But nonetheless, the idea lingered that if he or his spirit was anywhere in the world, then it would be here. She thought it almost natural that if his spirit were on this stretch of strand, he would have his own concerns. The details of her life, her job, or what might happen in future with the children, these would be matters that would seem as vague to him as the far distance did now to her, things that would pass as his life had passed. What had happened in the days before his death, The blockage in his system that caused him to cry out so his voice could be heard through the hospital, that would be with him now more than anything else. It came to her again, his death. She pictured those who were there, Jim and Margaret, his brother and sister, and Sister Thomas, the nun from the convent of St. John of God, who had said special prayers, and then old Father Quaid. For the last 2 days, Nora herself had stayed by his bedside, but he was already far away from them, so far that they might have been like shadows, people already lost to him. Maybe he could only imagine them all as vague presences, the ones he had loved. But love hardly mattered then, just as the haze here now meant that the line between things hardly mattered. As she reached Ballyvaloo, and the luminous grey whiteness was moved down the strand by the mild wind towards Curraghcloe, she saw that there was a single nun walking back towards the lane that led to the retreat house of the Sisters of St. John of God. Wearing a full black habit, she walked slowly and with difficulty. Nora thought that she must be one of the retired nuns who often came here on holiday or on retreat. When she was closer, she saw that the nun was Sister Thomas. Nora was surprised that she was in Ballyvaloo. She had not known that she ever spent time away from her own convent in the town. She moved towards her, and when she reached her, Sister Thomas greeted her and put out her hands and took both of Nora's hands and held them. Suddenly, Nora felt cold and began to shiver. She could hear a wind blowing, almost whistling in the distance. But when she looked out at the sea and down the strand, it all seemed calm. There was no sign of the haze lifting. "You shouldn't be here on your own," Sister Thomas said. "I was in Blackwater this morning to see a friend, and just a while ago she saw you fast asleep in the car and then driving towards the strand, and she phoned me in the convent because she was worried and wanted to know what she should do about you. So I walked down here in case I would find you." "Who saw me?" "I thought I would come down to the shoreline to see if you were here," Sister Thomas said quietly. "I don't often leave the retreat house. Today it's more like heaven than earth down here." "I saw her all right," Nora said. "Someone who can't mind her own business." "That is one way of putting it," Sister Thomas said. "Someone who's looking out for you." Sister Thomas released Nora's hands. I was not surprised to see you down here," she said. "It was meant to happen, us meeting like this. This is how the Lord works." "Don't tell me how the Lord works," Nora said. Don't tell me that again." "When Morris was dying," Sister Thomas continued, "I asked the Lord to make it easy for him and for you. I have no needs of my own, and I had not asked him for anything in a long time, but I asked him for that, and he denied me what I asked. Now, there must have been a reason for saying no, and the reason is hidden from us. But I know that he's watching over you, and maybe that is why we met, so I could tell you that. He has not been watching over me. No one has been watching over me. I knew when I woke today," Sister Thomas said, "and said my prayers this morning, that I was to see you." Nora was silent. "So turn back now before the fog comes down so hard that you won't be able to drive home," Sister Thomas said. "Go home, and the boys will be home soon. The boys will be home from school waiting for you." I can't work in that place anymore. She shouts at me. She said things today that made it impossible for me to stay." "It will be all right," Sister Thomas said. "It is a small town. It will guard you. Go back to it now. Stop grieving, Nora. The time for that is over. Do you hear me?" "I felt as I walked along here," Nora began. "We all feel that on days like this," Sister Thomas interrupted, "and even on other days. It is why we come here. Those who have passed on have it for shelter on their way elsewhere. It is nice to be among them on a day like this." "Among them? What do you mean?" "We walk among them sometimes, the ones who have left us. They are filled with something that none of us knows yet. It is a mystery." She held Nora's two hands again and then released them, and then turned and walked slowly, as though in pain, back towards the dunes and the lane leading to the retreat house. Nora waited to see if she would look back, but she did not. So Nora stood for a while without moving, looking out at the sea still covered in haze. And then she began to make her way along the Strand towards where she'd left the car. The large scissors were on the front passenger seat beside a packet of cigarettes. She put the cigarettes in the glove compartment, but took the scissors out of the car and left them down on the gravel for someone else to find. Thank you.
That was marvelous. I think I was supposed to come up here earlier, but then I decided to leave you here all by yourself for your reading. Seemed more appropriate. Thank you.
You've got all the questions written down, do you?
Well, look how messy they are. I may or may not refer to them. It's just these are my scissors. I'm so glad you read both parts. I asked Colin if he might read the part where Nora gets her hair done. And in a way, the part with his sister on the beach is quite serious by comparison. But before this amazing moment happens where she says that you're essentially communing with the dead in this part of town, more or less, they relate for me and to a question I'd wanted to ask you. I mean, they're really both about Nora sort of proceeding with the grand theatrics of her own bereavement. No? I mean, she's lost her husband, and she's also, by that death, also suddenly radically alienated from everyone else. Maybe she always was, but she didn't really have to deal with them. And it especially the first chapter of the book, it made me think a lot about this people without realizing it imposing on her with their own need to find some way to behave appropriately.
Yeah, I wonder if it's significant that the state, the Irish state, was founded on, you know, the execution of a large number of men who left these widows who were young enough to continue wandering the city of Dublin with this immense mixture of power and powerlessness in their steely glances. And therefore, for example, Yeats's muse Maud Gonne, her husband, John McBride, was executed by the British, the 1916 rebellion. And she became Madame Gonne McBride, and she wore black. And she would go and visit the Archbishop in black, and she would walk the streets in black. And all the widows of the leaders, this was a very powerful thing as the new state was being founded, these women who had this strange power. And also, widows didn't marry again. It would be very, very unusual. I have a very clear memory, really clear memory, of the absolute outrage in Ireland. The island itself going into a mourning when the great widow herself, Jacqueline Kennedy, was going to get married again, because people were in Ireland were so happy with her the way she was. You know, because widowhood, even if you look at the statistics, men died earlier, leaving widows. So a widow in a town, I remember this vividly because my mother was a widow. And my father died when I was 12, and she was 46. And there was a funny mixture of things where, as you say, people would come to the house, but almost to pay homage to her widowhood. And the sadness was not something easily given up. So the dyeing of hair would be a considerable thing to do for a widow, because widows were not meant to do that. And, things are changing very fast in these years. When my grandmother died a few years before my father, her daughters all wore black for a year. And that would be absolutely normal. They just went downtown on the day she died and bought an immense quantity of black clothes and wore them for a year. And then when the year was up, they wore ordinary clothes. But by the time my father died, that had stopped. The problem was no one knew what color to wear. I mean, you couldn't wear pink, but you could wear dark blue. It became that was a very big change, that movement from wearing black for a year to not doing so.
There's a scene in the book when Nora, she has to make a living after her husband dies, and so she goes to work at this mill, right? And I think she wears a bright red raincoat, and is worried that people are going to see her on the street.
Yeah, that
and
red raincoat becomes, she realizes that almost a shame that she's going to have to go back to work, and the idea that what should you wear? I mean, how dowdy should you be? You know, and but you were meant to be efficient looking too. I mean, there was no point in going all dowdy because you were meant to be, you know, looking, wanted these people to keep working with you. So that whole idea of care and clothes isn't just, you know, on top of the book as a sort of icing. It's there at its core in some funny way.
It's really, for me, it seems like it's this, it is a sort of the theatrical encasing of the widow because it's how she appears. And she moves through the town, everybody's watching her.
Yeah, I mean, my mother had two younger sisters, and then there were other women would come, and they could talk about clothes for 2 or 3 hours, different coats they almost bought, and oh, another coat, and might get a coat altered. And I would realize, because I was always listening to them, that there was really something else on their minds all the time that no one was mentioning. I was looking to see where they're going to at any point mention it. But so this would become a sort of alibi, a sort of way of just chattering so that the real thing could never be discussed.
Is there something specific you have in mind that they weren't mentioning, or it was just always that way?
Well, you see, sometimes it would just be my father's illness and my father dying. Other times they could be having a fight about something major between them, but they would not mention. My mother would be in such a rage over something one of them had done. But somehow I'd be watching to see when this was going to be mentioned. No, they just discussed coats and...
Yeah.
And
something. You have there's a line in the novel Brooklyn also deals with the... Or it opens in the... Well, it's a wonderful opening of the... In the town of Enniscorthy, you say? I was saying Enniscorthy. And then they go back there in the end. But there's a line in that book... they could do everything except say out loud what it was they were thinking.
Yeah, you see, I think this is an interesting thing for a novelist. And you can't really get it in the theater, or I don't think in film very well, where the reader can know what people are really thinking. And then the writer can show that they're not, that language or conversation even becomes a way of concealing rather than disclosing. So you have two things going on against each other. And so the novel becomes a very interesting way of sort of handling that idea.
Yeah.
You know, that you can dramatize it, you know, by making both clear.
Well, Nora obviously has a lot of feelings and opinions about other people that she doesn't express. But there seems to be, in a lot of your work, although not in Mary, which is sort of its own thing, its own animal. In a lot of your work, people find themselves doing nothing and saying nothing. And I'm friends with Colm to some degree and call upon him for advice. And whenever I do, he says, darling, you are to do absolutely nothing about that. And it's always the best advice. And so... when I was rereading Nora to have this conversation, I kept getting to this fabulous moment where someone says, when it's Nora's, you know, tells herself privately that she would say nothing about that. Like, for instance, she joins a union and decides she'll say nothing about that to anyone in her family. And it's very controversial to join the union because the bosses, of course, consider it, quote unquote, rude. But that's just greed being used as a form of propriety. In any case, this do nothing, it made me wonder if this is a sort of Irish trait. It's a real talent, the ability to be silent, to remain silent, and to not express certain feelings when there's really no gain to doing so.
Yes, that it's a world where it's almost bad manners. I mean, it's quite odd being in America sometimes, or being in Brazil, even worse sometimes, where... you know, it would always be very bad manners to talk about yourself under any circumstances. And always bad manners if you were very uncomfortable in a seat, you're taught from very early age, well, don't mention that to anybody now because, you know, it's very, you know, just don't make a fuss of yourself under any circumstances. But there's also a literary thing there that you look, for example, at something like Antigone, and you think, well, that's a very dramatic story. And it must have worked wonders for the Greeks, and it still does indeed. Actresses love being Antigone, coming out and roaring and things. But I'm more interested in Ismene, her sister, who doesn't want her to get involved with Creon at all. Wants her to stay home more. And wants her just to be quiet. And wants her not to bother with the burial of the brother, because it will just cause untold trouble. That figure, if you're a novelist, I think, becomes more interesting, because you can show her over time as she attempts to keep things withheld within, quiet, while all the time they're raging somewhere, right, but not raging in the use of voice or in the dramatization of the self.
It's like the chorus pleading with Medea not to do anything rash.
Yes, but that's exactly right. In other words, that if you look at those texts, you think, for dramatists and actors, they're wonderful. For novelists, they're almost no use, because it's over before it starts. In the sense, you want to know, what happened 2 years later? When they were at home one day and there was nothing much going on, it wasn't even raining. What did one of them finally say to the other? And what you can get, you see, what you can get there, just say that you just get a morning, you get this nothing business. Elizabeth Bishop has it wonderfully in a poem where she finds a house. She said she'd love to do nothing or nothing much in the house for years. I love the idea of nothing or nothing much. So,
but that's a woman who had no trouble speaking her mind, I have to say. Elizabeth Bishop.
Well, I've just written a book about her, and there is no poem in which she refers openly or obviously or explicitly to the death of her father when she was 6 months old, or to her mother going insane when she was five. There's a short story about her mother going insane when she was five called In the Village. But both of those things were kept out of the poetry. The suicide of her lover of many years was kept out of the poetry. So there is a huge withholding, which I associate with northern landscapes and with places close to the sea, with her upbringing in Nova Scotia, with that landscape down there. If you ever spend time around Halifax and try and get at someone to say something that they're really thinking about for a second, and they look at you for a long time and then say, you get all those ways the voice can work without anybody saying, well, I didn't like something, or I don't want something, or could you go away now? You know, those things will never be said, because somehow or other the winter is too long and the enmities could be too great in a northern landscape going from Canada across Ireland. And it may even, in fact, explain certain things that are going on in Ukraine and Soviet Union, you know, where people just, the winter is really very long and you need to be very watchful in a long winter.
That's a great answer. Just quickly, when is your... I knew that you were writing a book about Elizabeth Bishop. Yeah. I was just thinking more of her letters where she get a bit bitchy.
But there's also a lovely thing in the letters where she can regret everything. You know, she's in Brazil. She's having a whale of a time. They have sports cars and servants and toucans. And, you know, like the clouds are so great. They come in, the clouds come into rooms. It's also exciting. And she just says, you know, I would give anything to be in Nova Scotia now with the leaves coming off the trees. I'd love to see that. You know, there was never ease in that.
Discontent.
I'm sort of interested in that, you know, because she also wanted on her gravestone to be written, awful but cheerful. which I think is really wonderful, isn't it?
She wanted that.
Yeah, oh, she has it. She got it. It's there.
Oh, that's on her gravestone.
Oh, it's in Worcester. You go to Worcester in Massachusetts, yeah.
Did you go to the gravestone? Yeah. Wow. But did you ever, since coming here, you've obviously spent a great deal of time in the States and also in Spain, where people are more emotive, I would say. Do you ever wish that you came from a tradition where people are very frank about their emotions? I mean, to me, it seems like, because I come from a family where everyone's very frank, it seems incredibly vulgar to me. And I idealize this fantastic ability to do nothing, say nothing.
I'm interested in it more as what you can do with it in fiction. I've stopped thinking about it in any other way. I've stopped wanting to be different than I am. I did go to therapy where I did ask one day if I could, you know, if I could integrate my personality a bit more, you know, and they asked me, well, he asked me, which would I like to be, you know, what? And I said, oh, well, I didn't know. I said, well, you know, go away. And, but you know, I suppose I just want to toss the question back to you, which is that the whole idea in a novel of the amount of the self that is available to you when you're working, and that you put into the novel as a set of secret signs, some of which only you know, some of which someone may know in the future, some of which knows, someone who knows you well might know, but the reader will not know. You know, and people could ask you, well, of course, you must know Italy very well. You must have been on a motorbike a lot in your, you know, like, just presume, and you say, well, actually, that's not me. Yeah. But that's not quite the answer to that question ever, is it? Because,
no.
You know, a poem can come from a thought or half of a thought or an image, but a novel has to come from a life because you have to put in so much detail and so much time has to go by. It's 1,000 details, maybe 2,000. And the mind is lazy. So you go and you look, when you need a detail, you think of, oh, I need a door. Oh, I know a door. And you use a door, you know. And then you think, well, opening the door, what did they see? And you think, I'm going into a room that is so familiar to me now that I never thought I would go in, you know, even in memory. I mean,
yeah,
when
absolutely.
I mean, when you were writing The Flame Towards, I mean, because it's so mysterious when you're reading that book as to how much of you, I mean, the details. I don't just mean the overall concept, but the small things.
It's like that. I mean, that was very well described. I mean, I guess, you know, Proust would call it involuntary memory, right? When you position yourself in such a manner that you were able to think deeply and you begin to see things that you've held on to in all of their particularity, but you don't think about them on a daily basis, and so they don't get shaped into those shapes that memory mythologies get shaped into when we've decided that these X, Y, and Z were our experiences. There's something else underneath all of that. But it's so complicated, I think, when you're writing a book, what the effect is.
Isn't that almost like therapy, where you're involved in talking in a sort of formalized environment, and something or other can occur to you as memory,
yeah,
as significant thing that might matter as an image. So it has a connection to that, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't really. Therapy is not, that word is too normative for me.
So what word would you use?
Well, more like an analysis or something.
Oh, kind of. Yeah, it's all the same. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Now I'm doing that thing we were talking about earlier when the sorry, when the interviewer or interviewee takes issue with the terminology and gives the interviewer or interviewee a hard time, and I didn't mean to do it.
Therapy.
But, well, let's get back to the fiction part of it, because okay. I think that is really interesting, because when you're writing and you come across real material that has detail, that is, you can see it, and you're seeing it through language, right? It's not just like a cinematic image in your mind. You're creating it by tunneling into language. I often think that it's one of the only ways a person, at least like myself, really has of encountering herself is through the writing. It's like meeting yourself in a dark alley or something. You come up with all these things, and it's not just in order to be able to describe a door, because you need a door for your story. It's like you needed to go through that door and create this alternate portrait of your own experiences in your mind, no? But it's not autobiography.
Yes, I think that's interesting. It's not autobiography, because the page, I mean, I work on pages still, and pens and stuff, but
he writes
the screen,
with a fountain pen.
Yeah, but the screen or the page is not a mirror. It is actually blank. So it's not as though you're actually creating yourself, looking at yourself and saying, this is me, and I'm not going
right.
to describe myself. It's a more mysterious process because it's blank, and you need to think of something to fill it. So the next sentence has to come. I mean, you're better off if you're writing to write the next sentence than not. You know, I mean, you could say, well, maybe I won't, but someday you'll have to. And therefore, do it now, because something is coming now. And the strange thing, I wonder what you think, because I think it's all over the flamethrowers, is that it comes in rhythm sometimes as much as it comes in any obvious moment that you could say, yes, this is the day we all went to the beach. But somehow in rhythm, you're capturing something, an emotion that was lost to you, or you never thought you would have again, or you'd be able to formulate in any way. And language then becomes a thing. But it's not just words as things that give information. It's words that have a soul as much as a body, have a sound as much as a meaning.
Cadence, I think, is very important. Yeah. And with you, especially with the new book, but all of them, really, there's such a sinuousness to the cadence.
Are you sure? Because I'm trying to keep it down, that sinuousness, into a sort of blankness so that you could read a paragraph thinking, well, there's nothing in that paragraph at all. I mean, there's no big word. There's no obvious truth. There's no philosophy. There's no politics. It's just a whole lot of little sentences added one after the other.
But they're very, I guess by sinuous, I mean that they flow without being encumbered by density. And in terms of back to this idea of consciousness and harboring much more than you say, or feeling the opposite of how you might come across to others in the room, I read this essay by you, a wonderful essay about a writer, I must confess I don't know, an Irish writer who's probably very well known in Ireland, Brian Moore. And you were talking about his work, and I thought of your work, because you mentioned that he treats consciousness as though it were a kind of innocence. So that the way I took that to mean, without having read his work, is that the person is sort of going through their life, it's being described. They encounter this situation or that situation, they have to make a choice and behave in a certain way. And it's not up to the reader to judge them. Whatever they are doing, we are now allied with them. And they're just making their way, and I think your sentences sort of make their way in a similar capacity.
I mean, I think if you were going to put a name on this, you might call it third person intimate, where your job is, if you're using the third person, is to create so many details that seem right, and then leave so many of them out that the reader has to imagine half of what's happening. And then but real detail has been given for the other half. So the reader slowly, and everything is from the protagonist's point of view. So no one else is allowed to see, notice, remember, or feel, or even be, except as they're watched by the protagonist. So the reader slowly, therefore, enters into the spirit of the protagonist. And, I mean, Henry James formulated this, I think, better than anybody, and probably did it better than anybody, where there's no author, and but there's almost no reader, but where the reader and the protagonist become one.
Yeah.
And you begin to feel and watch and see and notice within real time that the protagonist does, without being given all the details. Because if you've been given all the details, and particularly, as you say, if you've been given an analysis of how they're feeling, then the reader will actually withstand that, will have a way of being able to keep then. That's a distancing process. Whereas I'm talking one where you bring the reader very, very close.
Right. Just hearing you talk reminded me of something else I wanted to ask you, because there are these, as Nora sort of starts to figure out what she's going to do and who she's going to be with that new hair and without her husband, she becomes interested in music. And it's a wonderful way that you narrate the whole account of her kind of growing interest in music and not wanting to ally herself with a kind of pretentious doctor on the edge of town, but figure out a way to maybe learn enough about music to go to Dublin and buy some records. And she joins this society, the Gramophone Society, and they sit and listen to music. And I was thinking about that today, and I sort of thought, music maybe is a way of sending into the room, into the commons, things, between characters that cannot be said. So, like, we know that Nora has a kind of an entire unspoken interiority and soulfulness that is only expressed in the way that she describes in her very intimate interior voice to us what it feels like to listen to Beethoven's Archduke Trio.
Yeah, I mean, it poses certain problems. It's very, very difficult to write about music, and the golden rules.
He does it so wonderfully.
Well, no, but you just simply apply a rule to it. No similes, no metaphors, and no sugar. You know, I mean, simply the thing. Go to the thing, and don't say it was like waves crashing over. I mean, do not do that. And but there are two sources for this in a way. One of the sources is entirely autobiographical. There was a man that used to tour Ireland called Charles Lynch, and he was a hero really because he brought Liszt and he brought Debussy to small towns. He would come on his own and play the piano in the parish hall. He would be wearing a monkey suit, the whole business, and the baby grand piano, and he was marvellous. But my father and my uncle really, really lived in fear of him because they would have to go to the concerts because they were always fundraising for something. And Charles Lynch, they just couldn't believe the boredom of having to listen to him play the piano for all that time. And the thing they hated most was the encore. And, you know, they'd say, just when we thought it was over, he went back down and sat down again. We couldn't believe he was starting off again. And
did your mother make him go?
No, they would have to go because it would be parish something, or it would be political. It would be to do with fundraising. They would dread it. And my mother would be quiet during all of this. But so that when my father died, it emerged that my mother had to start going out. She'd only ever gone out with him. And there was this thing on a Thursday night in the town called the Gramophone Society. And so innocent, you know, they would bring an actual stereo from a car into the hotel and they would sit around and listen. And, you know, that was how she started her life again. But the other source for that is a literary source, which is about, I think it's the last 100 pages of Thomas Mann's Buddenbrooks, which is where music becomes the thing that keeps that household going after the death of the father. And Hanno, the child, is playing, and he's this very exotic mother of his. This is the world that takes over from the ordinary world of domesticity that has been broken, is a world filled by music, as though somehow or other music will keep everything at bay. It will be pure feeling, so that you won't have to have banal feelings. And Mann handles this very well in the book. He makes it into a sort of disease in the end. I mean, it's what kills Hanno, the music. It's a romantic thing, whereas I wanted to make it an enabling thing. And we were talking before about this, where that album of the Archduke Trio, an LP, as they used to call them, of Jacqueline Dupré in the middle, and on the other, and Barenboim here and Pinchas Zukerman here playing the Beethoven trios, you had in your house as well.
Yeah, well, when I was reading the book, there's a few scenes where Nora is musing over the image, and for her it represents ethereal possibility. If her life had gone a completely different way, she might have been this open, contented, excited face of the young woman on the record, right? I mean, yeah. You describe it much better. But I had this very strong feeling when I was reading it, this is a real album that was probably in Colum's house when he was a boy, or he bought it himself when he went away to school in Dublin. I didn't know how serious of a classical music listener you are, but I think you're very serious. So I was just thinking about that, and then I realized it's Jacqueline Dupré. And so I asked my mother if we had that record, and she sent me a Google image of it, and I remembered it very strongly because they look like Peter, Paul, and Mary. They look like these very groovy young people, and he has these big sideburns like my father had.
Yeah, the two men are so darkly handsome, but in the middle she's extraordinary because she's the cellist. She's the one actually making the dark sound.
Right.
You know, it's not as though she's sitting at the piano being, you know, like she's the one actually.
Nora's
the
very aware
of
that in the book.
And this becomes, Nora actually at one point, I mean, she's been drinking, I mean, this doctor gives her all this gin and tonics. She actually wonders, she wonders for a second, it's the only moment I let something like that into the book, what accident it was that caused her to be her,
yeah,
and Jacqueline Dupré to be Jacqueline Dupré, and not the other way around. You know, how easy it might be to actually have been somebody else with all those eggs and sperm wandering about. You know, that it just could have gone somewhere else. And she just thinks that for a second, because she would have given anything, in a way, to be somebody else. You know, in the book.
Speaking of other Noras, I just have to ask, and then I think I'm meant to open it to questions. There is no obvious link for me between the two, but because Nora Barnacle is such an infamous character and real person for Irish literature, were you at all referencing her in giving the protagonist her first name?
No, it was a very common name at home for women of that generation.
It's just a really common name.
I probably should have thought of some other and better name. But I like the sound of the name, Nora. And, you know, it was better than Deirdre or something, you know, or Mary. I mean, really. And therefore, I liked the sound of it. And there were a lot of Noras. And also in this part of Ireland, the southeast, because it was so open, you know, to invasion from the Cromwellians or the Elizabethans or the Normans or the Danes, or you could list them. They went on forever, those invasions. That the name Webster you will find in Wexford, in County Wexford. You won't find it further north than there. So the name...
So it's very true to the region.
Anyone from home looking at the name Nora Webster... I mean, I'm not making this up, but I had an email from a woman via my website saying my mother was Nora Philomena Webster. And wondering, had I used her mother's name? Because I hadn't. It would have been both Nora and Webster.
Lovely.
Would just be very common names, yeah, at home. I mean, I realize there's a literary background to this. I probably should have done something about it, but I decided not to.
No, I mean, maybe I shouldn't have asked about that. But then I have to ask one last question about Enniscorthy. Do people from home? I mean, Colm is the most famous living Irish writer. I don't know if people
No, John Banville is the most famous living Irish writer.
Kidding.
No, Edna O'Brien.
I have been to Ireland twice.
Brian Friel. Give me a break.
I've been to Ireland with Colm. I was thinking if the library really wanted to make money, they would have this trip where you could go to Ireland with Colm Tobin. Every person on the street, when you say that you're there to do something with books, the taxi driver, the guy at the hotel, they all say, oh, well, have you read Colm Tobin? We have some great writers here. But so then I was wondering, with Enniscorthy, do people read your books looking for something of themselves and familiarity and what they know? I mean, do you ever feel constrained by that?
No, I don't. But I suppose people do that. But you see, things change so quickly. Because with the earlier generation, Edna O'Brien's early novel was burned, you know, in her village. My friend John McGahern, who died in 2006, but in 1965, his second novel was banned. And he was fired from his job as a teacher on the instructions of the Archbishop of Dublin. And the government became so embarrassed by this that they changed things really quickly. And this flood of foreign fiction came in. And also a sort of national shame over the years of censorship. So that a new thing began whereby, which I've never really fully trusted, whereby people think they like you. You know, and want you to come and read in the local library and get the book signed and look at you. Certainly with one of the books recently at home, well, a very strange moment was where two sisters who always go everywhere together sat separately in the audience so they could both look at me from different vantage points to sort of freak me out. And it was lovely. Ireland then, you know, because it's a separate language, Ireland, you know, the language of social intercourse in Ireland. I knew exactly what to say to them when they came up to get books signed because, of course, they wouldn't like it to be said that they hadn't done this. And so they came up to get books signed, and I said to them, well, it was lovely to see a friendly face. Meaning, wasn't. And they nodded in acceptance of the remark. You know, you can never, ever be sure in any small community like Ireland about the position, if you're in the business of making images, that at any moment people could just take enormous offence and return to the way they were before. But in the meantime, we just thank... I mean, it was a big struggle to get the books available, you know, and get rid of censorship. But it's something you would be always very careful with. And also, you could write a book that everybody could hate. And I have a few books that people pretend that don't even exist. No, really. And I don't think my novel, The Story of the Night, was particularly welcomed in the country. But when I read from it first in a town, a friend of mine's brother, of course, didn't come to the reading, but he found me in the pub in the town later on that night. And he just said, there's a lot of talk about you up the town. You know, so just, I wouldn't bet on all that, you know?
Yeah. Should I open it to questions? I'm asking Louise. Oh, I have time for that? I have so many questions. Well, I wanted to ask you about the way that you use water in really all of your books, all of your writing has some reference to it that's quite powerful. Like, whenever people sort of get together, the erotics take place in the sea, for instance. And whenever somebody really finds their own emotion about something, they're swimming. And then there's even this really wonderful moment when Donal, the son, is explaining the paradox of faith to his mother. And he says, the necessary, I'll probably bungle this as a raised atheist, but he says, the necessary precursor to faith is belief. And it's really quite simple, he says. It's just adding light to water. And I just thought, well, Colum and water, there's something for you that's very elemental about it, as if water is like the murky makings of art, something like that.
Yeah, but it's also just being from an island where, you know, we were 10 miles from the sea, but we spent, because my father was a teacher, we could spend all the summers there. And that business of the Irish Sea and willpower, I mean, that struggle, you know, in the month of June as the ice is still in the air and everyone's getting into the sea and you're under instructions to get in, you're up to here and there's a wave coming towards you and everyone's shouting, come on, you can do it, you can do it. And then you, you know, but also that I don't think anything much ever happened anywhere else but on those beaches. And I'm not interested in its symbolism, but I'm interested in its resonance, into just the whole idea of being close to water and water being just itself. I mean, rather than water being, say, death or eternity or
any
of those big things, just the actual business itself of water. But in that particular scene where he's trying to explain to his mother, he's becoming... You know, that idea of the paradox of faith within Catholicism, where you in order, as I say, to in order to believe, you have to believe, and then you can believe. You know, in other words, belief has to come as a sort of flash. And he's trying to think what to say. And I know, because of the way I work with place, I know exactly where they are now. They're on a hill outside Wexford town, and below them is Wexford Harbour. And the car would be facing towards the harbour, and he's looking at the water. And, you know, it's not a hard thing to think for him then it's like light on water, because he's looking at light on water. Because I cannot write the scene, even though there's no mention of what they're facing or where the car is. I can't write it without being able to fully see exactly where the car is in relation to the town below.
Yeah.
So if the car, you know, so that I have the scene fully in my head. So getting the image then comes directly from something I haven't mentioned up to now, which is that just below them, there's a
cool
harbour.
Yeah. Insane asylum, completely surrounded by water.
Yeah.
And I thought that was fabulous, and I got a big kick out of it. I heard it all over the country.
Next question,
Colum, I was curious about the response to Mary
in your experience, having written that book, Reimagining Mary and that whole Jesus business, and how people in Ireland, for example, responded to that?
The play Testament of Mary was performed first at the Dublin Theatre Festival by the actress Marie Mullen. And we had worked out a system whereby if anybody wanted to leave, there would be a way for them to leave very easily. Mm. And there were ushers there because we didn't know what the response would be. And again, it was very hard to judge what the response was because people wouldn't tell you. I got no abusive letter from anyone in Ireland. I'm very easy to find in Ireland. I got no abusive letter from anyone in Ireland, no abusive email, and no abusive review about the actual content, the actual religious content. But a very important and serious moral theologian came to one of the preview nights, almost as a warning. He was sitting at the end of a row, and I was walking up. I was still changing little words, and of course, I don't know him very well, but I know him, and he's a priest, and he's a very distinguished figure. He's written many books. And I knelt down, as you should under those conditions. I had to kneel down just to talk to him and say, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "Well, I just wanted to see what you were doing." And so anyway, afterwards, he stopped me on the way out and said, "Well, that was wonderful." So I looked at him, and he looked at me. And he said, "Well, of course, at my age, my hearing is not great. So you see, I missed most of it. But it looked wonderful." And then he walked by me, magisterially, meaning if you think that you're going to get publicity for your play by it being denounced by us, we're not giving you that. Thank you. Oh, I mean, we know enough at this point about. But of course, in America, such things are not still known. So a group from Pennsylvania came up on a bus and protested outside the theatre in Broadway on the opening first preview night and the opening night. And I got a lot of abusive emails via my website from Americans.
Now, can you tell them the name of this group? Do you remember?
No, do you remember?
The organization, I was there, the Organization for the Protection of the Family, Faith, and Private Property. Sorry to interject.
Whoa.
Seems important.
And I got abusive emails. And then when it opened in Spain, there was nothing either. There was just absolute indifference. It was just another play on by some writer. It's a funny business that the distance things have gone now.
If there are no more questions, you can visit with Colm and Rachel out in the lobby. I want to thank you for this delight of listening in on this conversation. Please join me in thanking.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.